Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. Hello. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Kicking off a brand new week here, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
Well, first, what about the storm update? I just read something released by Entergy Mississippi. They say they got all the crews out and about, restoring power. 45,000 customers lost power as these severe storms swept through the area. Entergy reports about an hour ago, less than 36,000 customers still without power, but 36,000, of course, is a lot. Man, they say they have more than 235 additional linemen, vegetation workers, and damage assessors. This is from their official press release, working alongside internal crews to restore power. You know, it was a nasty line. I don't know that I've ever seen those squalls move so rapidly. Seems like that the speed at which the entire line was moving accelerated as it approached the river. The river typically slowed it down a little bit, and then, man, it got through there and picked up speed. Here in central Mississippi, it appears, just anecdotally, that Rankin County incurred the most serious amount of damage. Lots of reports there, especially the south part of the county as the storms swept through. Also, southwest Mississippi and really just south central Mississippi, the Meadville area as well. I know we got listeners that'll probably let us know. But that's where we stand on that. Also, hot off the press, I mean literally within the last 30 minutes or so, the president-elect of the United States, Donald Trump, just announced his endorsement for Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to stay in place and remain as the Speaker of the House. The vote, of course, set for this Friday. I suspect that's a bit of a relief to the Speaker. And as we shared with you last week, the way the numbers fall out in the House of Representatives, 219 to 215, as you can see, a tie doesn't win it for you. You can't lose, but one. You got to have every other Republican, assuming all the Democrats vote the same against the incoming Speaker or the incumbent Speaker. Quote from Mr. Trump, "Speaker Mike Johnson is a good, hardworking, religious man. He will do the right thing, and we will continue to win," in all caps. "Mike has my complete and total endorsement, MAGA." This is from a post he wrote on his Truth Social platform about 30 minutes ago. So we'll see how this plays out. I know that Representative Thomas Massie, the Republican from Kentucky, he's already pronounced that he will not support Johnson. Several other hardline conservatives won't commit to supporting him, really won't tip their hand here. But the razor-thin GOP majority, again, means if Thomas Massie holds the line on his announcement and follows through with that, voting against the incumbent Speaker, that's it. You got to have everybody else. It's going to be a lot of drama, I feel like, on Friday. In the markets today, a surprising sell-off. I think because the markets were up so substantially throughout the year, what we probably have is a lot of profit-taking right now, and then folks are also that are harvesting losses, getting those in before the 12/31 deadline to include those gains and losses on their tax returns. That's what's going on there. So the Dow presently down about 475 points. It was down well over 500. I think it touched 600 earlier this morning. Yeah, it's 485 in the red is the Dow. The other index is the S&P, the NASDAQ down 275. So markets sell off today. Stocks are dropping in the final trading days of 2024. Really incredible to watch all that. And then, of course, sad news in that former President Jimmy Earl Carter passed away at the age of 100. That occurred yesterday. And tributes are pouring in from lawmakers, Mr. Trump, President Biden. All of those are offering condolences and making statements. This is Mr. Trump speaking. Those of us who have been fortunate to have served as president understand this is a very exclusive club, and we can only relate to the enormous responsibility of leading the greatest nation in history. That from Mr. Trump's Truth Social account. The challenges Jimmy faced as president came at a pivotal time for our country, and he did everything in his power to improve the lives of all Americans. For that, we all owe him a debt of gratitude. Melania and I are thinking warmly of the Carter family and their loved ones during this difficult time. We urge everyone to keep them in their hearts and prayers, the incoming president also stated. Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States, dead at 100. You know, it could be argued, I guess, Rhino, that it's Watergate, honestly, that propelled him into office. I think, just to think about that today, that seems like such a trivial event relative to today, if you think about it. But Americans at the time, I remember it well. I was graduating from high school, headed to college, and I think Americans were looking for a change in what at least they thought was perceived to be restoring so-called decency to the office, and he presented himself as a decent man. Peanut farmer, rose to the level of state senator, became the governor of the Peach State of Georgia, and then just came out of the blue. I mean, you think governors are obscure today. I mean, if I asked the average person on the street, you know, who's the governor of some state remote to us, probably couldn't tell you. But it was even worse back then because you didn't have the availability of information and news the way we do. Literally everybody said, who? And he went on to win. Now, he got trounced 4 years later. He seemed to focus more on foreign policy, and that was a big deal. No doubt. And he did a lot good there. He did some stuff that I would consider not so positive for the country with respect to foreign policy as well. But he completely ignored the economy. And if there was ever a case where the economy was the number one factor in a presidential election, I think it's fair to say it was 1980 when Ronald Reagan came about, and just talk common sense about government and government's role in society and just how important and how critical the performance of the economy is to the average American. And that made sense to a lot of people. So he won, and then, of course, he ran for re-election and carried every state but one. in 1984. And the only state he didn't carry, as you recall, was Walter Mondale's home state of Minnesota in terms of the Electoral College. But Jimmy Carter, dead at the age of 100.
I'm observing the time-honored principle of if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough, my friend. No problem with that. Also, an airplane skidded off the runway, burst into flames. This was in South Korea. Looking at that video was rather harrowing. And then still images of that airplane just in pieces, all burned up at the end of the runway. Why was this big old concrete block there at the end of the runway? I mean, normally those are for noise abatement, but right there at the end of the runway, fairly close, had it not been there, aviation experts say it would have just skidded on through, busted through a fence, ended up on a road, and probably everyone would have survived. It's thought that the airplane encountered a bird strike, perhaps affected its hydraulics. No, nobody knows, but they do have the recorders, and I'm sure we'll learn more. Coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
We are back in the Element Well studio. Thanks so much for joining us today. Mike from Columbus says, all I remember is gas lines and Billy Beer from the Carter era. Yeah, you know, I remember that, Mike, but perhaps even more prominently etched in my brain was the hostage crisis. And it's just one of those things where he seemed confused, didn't have a strategy, didn't have a plan. And I think, to a great extent, his weakness is exhibited on the global stage. Embolden the Ayatollah.
Well, in fairness, I do believe he had a plan. It's just that his plan did not work.
Okay, fair
his
enough.
His plan was to ask nicely.
Yeah, fair enough.
Wasn't a very good plan, but it was a plan.
And then, of course, sent the U.S. military in for a rescue mission, and that was perhaps one of the biggest failures in the history of the U.S. military. 8 service members, I believe, perished in that incident, as I recall. Yeah, so he did do a decent job, I think, of brokering a Middle East peace deal, of course, at the time at least, but that it didn't stick. We still have turmoil and tumult in the Middle East. That hasn't gone away, for sure. Carter, this is on the ceasefire text line. Carter was as good of a man as has ever been in office. May not agree with his policies, but he was a great man. I think, yeah, that's true to a large extent from a character perspective, an integrity perspective. I don't know that I've ever seen any scandal, even any remote mention of scandal. But maybe, as Rhino said, he was kind of too nice. I mean, there's a fine line there. And you got to know who you're dealing with. I think perhaps trying to put words in your mouth, but
I wasn't going to say he was too nice. He was self-serving. And that was the public persona he encouraged, was that he was too nice.
I think that's probably right. But nonetheless,
that was part of the problem the Middle East peace deals fell apart was when he couldn't get them to agree to something, he just came out to the public and lied about it. And then it all fell apart because it was all based on a lie. But it was all for so he could look like he accomplished something.
I agree. You know, to me, it was really an issue in that he was just hyper-focused on that. I mean, he really enjoyed that role as the president, being the peacemaker. He really thought that's what he was anointed to do, but he sort of ignored domestic issues, thus the long gas lines, as Mike from Columbus points out, the rampant inflation. And he looked totally confused on dealing with those issues. Just really didn't want to, like, just go away sort of deal. Let me go deal with Middle Eastern issues and see if I can broker more peace there. Man, oh, man. So flashing up on the screen, another Ukraine aid package announced by the Biden administration.
$2.5 billion.
Quote, at my direction, the United States will continue to work relentlessly to strengthen Ukraine's position in this war over the remainder of my time in office. You know, speaking of which, just his time in office, he's in the Virgin Islands, as we discussed last week. And as is appropriate, he did address the nation yesterday concerning President Jimmy Carter's death. But once again, it was that he was kind of hoarse, you could tell, and it just had that sort of bitter, mean personality, if you caught any of that, and that kind of creepy whispering that he does, leaning into the mic, of course, taking the opportunity to hurl stones at the incoming president. And I just thought it was inappropriate. I think just go out there and talk about the man and recognize his contributions and exhibit some condolences and sadness over his death. All that's perfectly appropriate. And he also discussed some personal interaction with a former president. But taking that opportunity again to hurl rocks at the incoming president, he just can't stop, can he? And that bothered me. I just didn't think that was the right time or place. And a reporter asked him what President-elect Trump should take from Carter's legacy, and Biden replied, decency. In my view, he should have said, really not here to talk about the incoming president. We're here to celebrate the life and remember the contributions to the nation of former President Jimmy Carter. To me, that would have been the proper response. But boy, it almost feels like it was staged, does it not? Because most of them are, that we've learned. He doesn't do very good. In fact, he does terrible with off-the-cuff sort of questions. I just thought that was inappropriate. Decency, decency, decency. Can you imagine Jimmy Carter walking by someone who needed something and just kept walking? Can you imagine Jimmy Carter referring to someone by the way they look or the way they talk? That was all, of course, intended to insult and accost the incoming president. I just don't think that's appropriate at this time. That's politicizing a death. The very thing they always accuse the right of doing, right? That's exactly what he did here. Politicized the death of a 100-year-old former president. Incredible. Very disappointing. Really is. Oh my gosh, what is this from Herschel? He's talking about Social Security. By the way, Social Security is an entitlement. Herschel, I would encourage you to look the definition up. I'm not trying to be condescending here. It means you're entitled to it. I don't know why everybody equates entitlement to welfare. It's not. They're two different things. Welfare is welfare. Entitlement means you're entitled to the benefits from the Social Security program. By the way, this is somewhat in the news because there's some adjustments to Social Security going into effect next year. I'm looking for the details. I read about this over the weekend. The first is that there is an upward adjustment due to the cost of living, automatic increase in benefits. And then there's also an increase in the limit, the cap on Social Security contributions. It rises as well. that has already been in place. So, and I'm not trying to be an argumentative about it, but I see this all over social media, and I think it's grossly misunderstood. Entitlement means just that. You are entitled to it. I think a lot of people conflate that with welfare, where welfare people, I've seen this, you've seen it, Rhino, I'm entitled to that. I've seen people, I've seen members of the Mississippi legislature, Democrats, of course, state that Medicaid should be expanded because people pay into Medicare. I've seen that. You're shaking your head. You know this has happened before. That's how little they understand about how revenues go into trust funds and benefits come out of them and where funding comes from for these various programs. Medicaid is 100% funded by income taxes, not taxes you pay to have a Social Security benefit or Medicare benefits when you're eligible for those. No. They're not conflated whatsoever. In fact, I got curious about Medicare over the weekend and Social Security as far as them driving the debt. And I know I'm a wonk. You know, you're really bored when you're reading the Social Security Trust Fund report. But the Medicare report and the Trust Fund report, since 2021, the contributions by employers and employees into the Social Security program now are exceeded by benefits going out. That's why we're headed to a point, unless something is done, by about 2032, when the government, the program, will not be able to pay full benefits. It will exhaust the trust fund, which is just a savings account, essentially. This is what's, I think, important to note. The Medicare program, which is funded by contributions, by premiums for Part B, etc., now is being funded to the tune of 46% by income tax dollars. In other words, all that money we pay into Medicare is not enough to sustain the program. It requires tapping income tax dollars, which are not designated for Medicare. And all that really means is we're borrowing money to pay for Medicare. That's why it's one of the key drivers of our deficits and debt. Coming right back in the Element Well studio, Senator Jeremy England at 11:05 today.
Hey, this is Will.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Well, the Dow has trimmed some of its losses. It's only down only $397. Crude oil up to $71. So there are some reports that there could be some roadblocks ahead for President-elect Trump's energy plans. Remember, he vowed to cut the cost of energy for Americans by 50% within a year. Man, I hope that's the case. I'm not totally sure how we get there. I would honestly think we'd have to experience a significant recession and a pullback in economic activity for that to happen, which would, of course, decrease the demand for oil, and that would certainly affect the price downward. Back to the Social Security adjustment, just so you'll know, folks, this is coming up next year, 2025, which is just a couple of days away. Monthly payments will rise by 2.5% through the standard cost of living adjustment. But the maximum taxable income limit for Social Security, that's going to rise from the present level of $168,600 to $76,000. $100. So you could see what that's $7,500. So an additional $7,500 of income will be subject to the Social Security income tax. Social Security tax, I should say. That not only affects employers, but it affects employees, but it affects employers as well. And then Social Security income payments for individuals, supplemental payments, in other words, not retirement payments, but supplemental payments, also known as SSI, for individuals will go up to $967 and $1,450 for couples. Veterans receiving benefits from the Departments of Veterans Affairs will also realize some of these similar adjustments, and it's all based on the spike of the cost of living. It's based on inflation. The CPIW specifically, that's the inflation measurement that is used to make these adjustments. Well, let's see on the C Spire text line. I was told that they done away with the Windfall Tax Act and so in Social Security. Is this true? I'm not really sure what that's referring to. Provide me some more information. There was a windfall profits tax that was instituted, gosh, this was back, I think, in the early, mid-'80s, on oil and gas companies. But that had nothing to do.
Yeah, that was part of the Internal Revenue Code of 86.
86, yeah. I think it was TEFRA was the law, if I'm not mistaken, the tax equity and financial responsibility. I don't remember what it stands for. TEFRA, something like that. Passed under Ronald Reagan, who also did sign off on law that taxed Social Security benefits.
And I do see a bill that was dropped by Representative Ro Khanna.
Okay.
That would amend that, but it hasn't gone anywhere, and it's was dropped.
Amend the windfall profits tax provision?
Yeah.
Okay. Would it that in any way carve out some of that for Social Security? I don't know that that's related.
I don't see it doing anything with Social Security, no.
Okay. Gotcha. Let's see here. Thomas in Greenwood says, my thoughts on Carter. Jimmy Carter was a perfect example of toxic compassion, where the need to appear compassionate overrides common sense, and you lessen yourself and your country to appease worthless people who elevate appearing to have compassion above all else. Well, so, Thomas, in that, are you indicting everyone that engages in legitimate, sincere, genuine acts of charity and compassion? This is to do with state employees who do not pay Social Security and the cut 30% of Social Security. Oh, okay. So we did talk about that. That has nothing to do with windfall profits, the windfall tax. There is, you're right. There is the Social Security Act that we talked about that a couple of weeks ago when it passed. I opposed this legislation. Okay, I see what's happening there. I apologize for my misunderstanding there. But yeah, there has been a law in the books for a long time that essentially discounts Social Security benefits to those who work for public sector entities who received a long time ago a waiver that that allowed them to not pay into Social Security, a waiver for paying into Social Security. So they participate in public sector pensions. That's the most common example. At the state, local level, I think in Texas, for example, there's a big railroad workers' pension, separate pension plan is one that comes to mind. And those workers do not contribute, nor do their employers, to Social Security program. And so when they apply for benefits, their benefits are adjusted accordingly. What just passed, both the House and the Senate, got signed into law, is legislation that essentially repeals that discount. And when it was originally enacted, it was called the Windfall something or another Social Security Act. I don't remember the exact formal name, but yeah, the word windfall, I do recall, Rhino, was included in the name of the legislation. So Yeah, I disagree with that totally. What it means, it's a cost of about $200 billion over 10 years. It means that the Social Security Trust Fund is going to go broke 6 to 8 months sooner than expected. It's really just kind of a handout to those who didn't pay into it. It's called the windfall elimination provision. Windfall elimination provision. So, yeah, this kind of happened without a lot of fanfare, Rhino. You and I talked about it on the program, but you don't see a lot about it in the news. You don't, you know, certainly the debacle that was the 4 or 5 days or 3 or 4 days of debating the spending bill, which has nothing to do, by the way, with Social Security. It just didn't enter the equation or the discussion. A few members of the legislature or the Congress did denounce it, did speak up in opposition, but nonetheless it passed. Passed both the House and the Senate, got signed into law. I'm curious to know if Senator England plans to file another early in-person voting bill next session. We're going to ask him about that. Ben from Madison asked. Yeah, I got that on the list, Ben. Thanks. Did I hear correctly that Biden issued an executive order allowing like 49,000 people not to have to return to work in the office? I don't know about an executive order. That's from LG and the Delta, but yeah, that's a big old problem in the federal government. That's been exposed, and I think to a great extent you'd have to credit Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy who've spoken up more on that issue perhaps more than anybody in the Congress. When they did a little digging, found out that about 6% of the federal workforce are going into the office, that we've got literally empty buildings all over the federal government complex, including the IRS building, the Hoover building in the Washington Capitol complex, which is basically empty. Found out that about 6% of the federal workforce is reporting to the office. And of that 6%, 5% of the 5 percentage points of the 6%, in fact, are maintenance and security personnel. And if you remove them from the calculation, you get 1% of the federal workforce. So we're spending, depending on whose report you read, somewhere between $6 to $8 billion a year to maintain these buildings that are empty. And yes, it is true that one of the unions inside the federal government workforce did just negotiate some contract that allows them to work from home until 2029. The president-elect, however, has vowed to order all these people back to the office. I suspect that means of the 3 million federal workers, a good number of them will retire early or just naturally attrit if they're told, you got to go back to the office. I honestly don't see how the IRS functions. That could be a good thing, honestly. It's dysfunctional now because of their primary function of these people that would be office workers is to work cases of possible tax evasion. That would be tax fraud. And that's just not something you can do by yourself. That's really difficult, especially these complex big dollar tax returns. You're usually going to have to collaborate and work with lots of other people that have various areas of expertise on these matters. It's just not something you can do independently from your home. Not effective. Why are a reduction on income taxes and grocery taxes presented as either or? That's on the ceasefire text line. It's a good question, and we'll talk about that on the other side of the break. Don't forget, it's Senator Jeremy England at 11:05.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays live from the Element Well studio. It just occurred to me, Rhino, the Trump inauguration occurs on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Huh. Interesting coincidence there. So on the ceasefire text line, this question we got that we read just before we went to the break, this was, let's see, Mike in Gulfport. Oh, no, this is a different question. Pardon me. I'll get to you in a minute, Mike. Thank you for that question as well. It's a good question. Can we not reduce both at a lower rate? This is regarding this issue. You know, is going to be front and center at the state capitol here in a couple of weeks, which is income tax, grocery tax, just some sort of tax reform, and the two big actions that are going to be deliberated is reduction of the income tax, reduction of or full elimination of the sales tax on groceries, combination of the two. So the question is, can't we do both? Neither side would be thrilled or angry. If one is happy, that's called compromise. Yeah, so we can. And I want to point out, Rhino, that was it 22? I can't remember when all this tax debate. I think that's when we started seeing legislation come out of the House in particular to eliminate the income tax. And you, as you recall, the very first bill actually increased sales taxes on everything but groceries, which it decreased. But it phased out on a very short time frame the income tax, full elimination. Got to the Senate, got killed. Didn't make it. We ended up the following year, I think I got this right, when we did get legislation, which we're under right now, which eliminated the 4% bracket of income taxes and then is phasing down the 5% or top bracket down to 4% over 3 years. And we got a couple of years left on that to get it down to the 4% level. So it's a math problem, the question is. And, yeah, I think you may see some sort of compromise. The governor has said in the past that, hey, I'd sign any bill that passes the legislature that reduces any taxes. I believe I'm accurately representing that. But he is no doubt championing elimination of the income tax. I don't know that I've heard him say a lot about the sales tax on groceries. On the other hand, you got the lieutenant governor, who I think's made it pretty clear that he is in favor of doing something about the grocery sales tax, if not full elimination, certainly a reduction. And that, of course, would put a hole in revenue to not only the state, but the diversions that go out to the municipalities where the transaction occurred. That would have an impact on their finances as well. And so I think, Rhino, it's fair to say every municipal leader that we've interviewed, when we've asked them about that issue, have said, yeah, I'm fine with that as long as the legislature makes us whole. So not only by reducing the sales tax on groceries would the state incur lower revenues from the state appropriated portion, designated portion, not appropriated, but the designated portion of the sales tax, but it perhaps would see fit to cover the losses in revenue at the municipal level. So the point I'm making is you sort of got a double whammy, less revenue to the state and more spending going out to cover the municipalities. And that would have to be baked into the math and the analysis and the economics. I submit it would make it, if we did such, certainly full elimination of the sales tax, the 7% sales tax on grocery, that it would make any kind of reform to income taxes virtually impossible. I don't think you'd get a chance of that pass. It's hard enough to get that through, honestly, the Senate without doing anything to the sales tax on groceries. But if you reduce revenues and if some analysis shows that by the state economist, for example, yeah, if you reduce or eliminate the sales taxes on groceries, this is what it means to the state's revenue. I think a lot of folks, certainly in the Senate, would say, yeah, that's it. We can live with that, but no income tax. So we'll see where that goes. And this is something that the and the speaker, I feel, and the governor are aligned on, and the lieutenant governor is not. But he has indicated, has the lieutenant governor, an interest in pulling back on the sales tax on groceries, if not full elimination. I haven't seen him say anything specifically about, yeah, let's reduce the income tax or eliminate the income tax, which is what the governor has stated is his desire for sure. But you know what? We got Senator Jeremy England coming on next. That's after Fox News and Super Talk News, and we'll pose these questions to him, see what he says.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher. Get ready. Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state.
Hello.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's hour two of Middays. Real quick, want to get to Mike in Gulfport's question. Didn't get a chance to before we went to break. Has the IRS hired all those 70,000 or so folks that has Trump said anything about nixing that? That's from the Inflation Reduction Act. 80,000 were funded. It turns out that the IRS since then, since 21, has added about 20,000 when you consider attrition, loss of employees, and then additional employees. So about a quarter of the total. Yes, the president-elect has certainly discussed defunding, if you will, or repealing the Inflation Reduction Act. That's going to be a little trickier than it meets the eye. You may need 60 votes in the Senate because it gets into the reconciliation rules, believe it or not. The Senate parliamentarian looks at that and says, wait, you're not going to hire as many IRS agents. That means revenue's going to be down because they're not out getting shaking down taxpayers, and that may require 60 votes. So it's complicated beyond belief. We're pleased to welcome now, thanks for waiting on that, the senator from District 31, is that right, Senator? 51.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
That's
Jeremy
right.
England. It looks like you're not in the deer stand right now, but I know I saw you post on social media. I think your daughter got one this morning, huh?
She did. She actually got two, Gerard. She got her first doe and her first buck. We just finished cleaning them. She's going to poke in and say hello real quick. So she's got blood on her face still. She was her first one. She's excited. We're up here.
Congratulations.
My good friend Charles Busby's place.
Yeah.
At Lake Eddins. So
Transportation Commission.
Back porch. That's right.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate you joining us today. So we've been talking this morning about some of the issues you guys might be debating down there at the Capitol. You're going to be all ready to go, I presume, a week from tomorrow. That's when you'll gavel in, start officially the 2025 session. Why don't we just dig right into it there, Senator? We've been talking about the prospect of some sort of tax reform here in the state of Mississippi, maybe building on the legislation that was enacted in 2022, which reduces the state income tax rate. Eliminating the 4%, that's already done, and then phasing down the 5% bracket over 3 years to 4%. What do you see happening this year?
Look, George, you already mentioned, so that's in place. So we're cutting taxes for the next several years, so people can look forward to that. We're going to get down to the 4%. Kind of a flat tax bracket for the individual income tax. I do think, and I heard you mention this before the break about the grocery tax, and I always like to remind people that we don't really have a grocery tax. We have a sales tax, and our sales tax applies to groceries. And so other states don't do it that way. But when you look at the parameters of what states do, we have one of the highest taxes on groceries. that being our sales tax. I think we're going to see an effort to get that down. The Senate's very strongly in favor of that position. But I also think that we're in favor of cutting the income tax more at some point. We'd like to see this 4% get phased in, but maybe shave another quarter off of that that flat tax, get it down to 3.75 or something like that. So we're always looking at cutting taxes, but we're doing it in a fiscally responsible way. We don't want to do it all at once and end up not being able to perform our functions that we need to perform as government.
You're probably aware, I know other members of the legislature are, we spoke to Senator Josh Harkins a few weeks ago. Of course, he's the tax man, as I call him over there.
That's right.
In the Senate. Right. But Louisiana just had a tax cut, and was it Arkansas, I think, as well, perhaps, and Alabama as well. So all of them seems like they're trying to get in line with Mississippi, maybe just nudging us out by a point or a fraction of a point to try to.
That's right. I think Arkansas went to 3.9 when we went to 4. So look, that's what competition does. We're competing, and so we need to keep competing.
Yeah. So no doubt this will be something that will see a lot of attention in the upcoming session for sure. I've never heard the lieutenant governor express any interest of significant reform to income taxes, but I've certainly, in my interview with him not so long ago, he expressed a desire, and he's talked to other folks as well, to take a hard look at paring down the sales tax on groceries. But here's the deal, as we talked about earlier, Senator, as you well know, I'm sure you've heard this from municipal leaders in your constituency. Hey, you guys are going to have to make us whole if you reduce the sales tax on groceries, because we rely quite a bit on that for our revenue.
That's right. Yeah, look, our municipalities and our counties, they rely very heavily on that grocery tax. And so there would be some, we would make them whole some way, right? We would find some way to do that. But when I look at all of the taxes and I look at us competing with other states, you know, we've got the lowest gas tax, at least one of the lowest gas taxes. Now we have one of the lowest state income taxes of states that do have an income tax. I think there's maybe 8 or 9 that don't have it. But we're one of the lowest there. Our grocery tax is one of the highest. So I'd like to see us bring that down so that when you look at the full spectrum of the different ways that we tax individuals here in Mississippi, that we're low all the way across the board. So that's what I think we'd like to do. And I've talked to the Lieutenant Governor about that, and we've talked about the state income tax. And I think that he wants to see that dropped a little bit lower. But again, we're doing it in a fiscally responsible way. We certainly don't want to cut to where we have to come back and raise some other taxes. We don't want to cut one area while raising another. We want to make it a net cut all across the board.
Gotcha. Something else that got a lot of attention in the last session, Senator, we're likely to see crop up again, and that's the issue of expansion of Medicaid. What do you see happening there?
So, look, I think we'll still hear that. That'll come up again, and that's a tough issue. For the longest time, I was a solid no on Medicaid expansion. Now, I voted for the Senate's plan last year, which had a work requirement. It only provided Medicaid expansion up to 100% of the federal poverty level. It didn't fully go all the way to 130%, so we weren't going to see people kicked off of their private covers that they were purchasing off of the exchange, which was being subsidized, by the way, and that's something we're going to have to look at. And look, it'll come back around, but as long as we have a work requirement, as long as we're not funding it to a degree that I don't think Mississippi would be able to afford it, the people that I worry about, Gerard, when we talk about Medicaid expansion, are people that I met when I was coaching my son in little league ball. The people who work at the front desk at a doctor's office or at the school have flexible jobs, and they're not making enough to, they're not covered by their work, and they're making too much to be covered by Medicaid. So they're in that what we call the coverage gap, and they're not able to cover themselves for health care, and which leads to them not going to get health care when they need it. And by the time they show up at the hospital, usually it's something that we probably could have dealt with. So, I look at it as a conservative approach to Medicaid expansion. I certainly wouldn't say Medicaid expansion is conservative by any means, but there's a smart way to do it, and we need to be looking at it. We need to be having the conversation.
You know, with President-elect Trump coming in, and I'm sure you've had this discussion with your colleagues for sure, who knows what might happen to the Medicaid program in general? I spent a whole segment talking about that last week. It turns out the governor ended up reposting it in his social media. Not sure if you saw that or not. But it really was more of just something the legislature should consider, which is there's a strong possibility that the federal government could reform the existing base standard Medicaid program, which could impose an additional cost burden on the states beyond just expanding and adding more.
That's right. Gerard, that's why I've been a no the whole time. You know, we've got the federal government that ties these strings to us, and we've just got to be careful. And I know I've said this on your show 100 times. I like moving slowly in the legislature, especially with issues like this. And if we just – the plan that the Senate came up with last year, and Senator Blackwell did a great job with it, and Nicole Boyd and Bryce Wiggins, they came up with a really good plan, working with the lieutenant governor, meeting with Senator Harkins and Senator Hobson. They came up with a really good plan that I could vote for. I don't think I could vote for anything that goes above and beyond that. The House plan I wasn't able to vote for, and I told them when we sent our bill to the House, and they were telling us, no, we're going to either get rid of the work requirement or we're going to go to the full 130%. I told them, well, you're not going to have my vote when it comes back to this other end of the hall. And I think most of my colleagues that voted on the Senate plan, we feel the same way.
Gotcha. You introduced a bill last year, Senator, I think it was the first time, to expand early voting in the state of Mississippi. Didn't get enacted, but do you plan to reintroduce that in the coming session?
I do plan to reintroduce that one, Gerard. Look, we passed it in the Senate 44-8. We had a hearing on it. I think we got some favorable comments on that. And I think Mississippians are ready to see a secure in-person style of early voting here in this state.
Gotcha. We're up against a break right now, Senator, but if you can hang with us, we can continue the discussion.
I can, absolutely.
Sounds good. We got Senator Jeremy England on the line with us on Middays. We're coming right back after this break.
With Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
We're back with you in the Element Well studio. Senator Jeremy England represents Mississippi's District 51, serves as the chair of the Elections Committee, vice chair of Ports and Marine Resources. So, Senator, again, about the early voting legislation, what were the objections to that? How come that couldn't get through?
Well, I think it was brand new legislation. And as you know, sometimes it takes us multiple years just to get people rolling on something, but it was a very conservative bill. You would have someone show up at their clerk's office with their valid photo ID. They would be printed a ballot, put it in the ballot box, and their vote would count up to 15 days prior to the election. And when it went over to the House, it was just they just weren't ready to take it up. We had a bunch of issues going on, as you know, every year. And I think we'll hear it. I think we'll get it back up this year. And look, the worst thing I heard this year were people showing up at their clerk's office because they were watching nationally. You know, hey, the news was, look, Republicans even are showing up in early voting in droves now.
Yeah.
And they would say, you know, hey, I'm here to early vote. And their clerks would say, well, we don't early vote in Mississippi.
Yeah.
And so they would just turn around and walk away. And I'm worried that's going to start happening. And so we're one of only three states that don't do it. And I think that we can really help a lot of our hardest working Mississippians out when it comes to having a chance to get out and cast their vote.
Well, you're right. The president-elect himself kind of changed his posture on that from the previous election cycle. And he and the RNC as well, big time, were promoting the idea, get out and bank your vote. Isn't that what I think the campaign was? Go ahead and get out and vote now. So
that's right. Bank your vote.
Bank your vote. Yeah. So I'm going to take a bit of a point of privilege here on this Medicaid deal with the work requirement, and it is dustly. I know there's a lot of focus on the labor force participation rate in our state, which is something that the Bureau of Labor Statistics computes. I did a fair amount of research on exactly what the methodology is they use to compute that figure. So I'm just going to put it out there like this. I've yet to meet a person in the state of Mississippi who's ever been caught by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I would encourage you to, anytime you're out in the public square, you're meeting with constituents, ask them, you ever been called? Ask your colleagues in the Senate and the House, ever been called? I've yet to meet a person that's ever been called in the state of Mississippi. In all my speaking engagements, I always pose that question. Raise your hand if the BLS has ever called you to see if you're working. I don't know how in the heck they calculate this number. I'm skeptical at best. I'm wondering if it doesn't make sense, Senator, for our legislature to commission a true, valid assessment of our labor force participation.
Yeah, look, Gerard, I'm not sure how it's assessed. I know that we're always on the wrong end of that list whenever they put out the rankings. It's like us in West Virginia, always at the bottom of the labor force participation rate. And I heard you say one time, and I think this may be part of it, is that, you know, we have a lot of craft workers that may work and just not be on the rolls, you know, and they're getting paid, with cash or some other way. And we don't know if they're being collected. I don't know what the methodology is. I certainly would support any effort to try to get a handle on that and see exactly what it is. And I'm sure it's already known. I just don't know what it is. But I also understand that if we have folks that are working and they can't afford health care because they're making too much, but they're not making enough to afford health care, that's got to be just devastating for your morale. You know, you got to feel like you're hitting a brick wall when you hit that coverage gap. Yeah. And, you know, there's an incentive there for them to just walk away and say, look, if I'm not working, I get health care because I'll be eligible for Medicaid. And we don't want that. We want people working in Mississippi.
Gotcha. Let's turn to the another hot button issue, I should say, which is school choice, education freedom. I know you've in the past you've been supportive of some measures there. We had a comprehensive bill come out of the House that would have phased in universal school choice over a period of time, but didn't get too far in the Senate, as you know. What do you expect this year?
I expect we'll see something, some movement on something, and we'll probably have a bill that we can send to the governor's desk. I like what the governor said in his executive budget recommendations, where he wants us to fully fund ESAs in Mississippi. I think that's a smart step forward. I hope that we're able to do that. I also think that we'll see students be able to transfer to different schools, to different districts, as long as the incoming school has the capacity and can accept them there. I think we'll see some movement there. And that's a small step. But, you know, we say school choice, but what we're really talking about is parental choice.
Yeah.
And it's parents always want to give their kids the best education available. And that's one way to do it. If they're not in a zip code or in an area that's got the best schools, we're holding them back if we're not letting them have that opportunity.
Do you think, Senator, we should investigate the prospect of some district consolidation? As you know, we have 138 districts in 82 counties, so we got a lot of overlap within the counties. Not so long ago, a good example is the home of Mississippi State University, your alma mater, Oktibbeha County, where Oktibbeha and Starkville City merged the school districts. That seems to have worked out pretty well. You think there's an appetite to look into that again?
I think so. I know there is one in the House, and I champion. I'm glad that they're championing that and you know, getting that conversation rolling. I think that a good way to start might be to look at areas that would voluntarily do that and let the locals make that decision and say, look, we can do better if we consolidate here and see what we can get there. The hesitancy that you find a lot of times in that is sports rivalries, oddly enough. But also, of course, you've got administrations that, you know, they might be an administration in one district and consolidate where they're out of a job. But we shouldn't worry about that, honestly. Yeah. You know, we need to make sure that we're putting funding directly to the students. So I'm glad we're going to be talking about that.
Well, I've asked you some questions about what I think may be coming up. What's on your agenda? What are you going to be working on?
Yeah, so Gerard, I've dropped a bill the last few years that it hasn't really gone forward. We've passed in the Senate and it gets to the House, and it just hasn't been worded well, I don't think. I think up front, I'm just going to flat out call this the anti-doxing bill. And what it's going to do, it would allow your first responders and your judges and your DAs and any public defenders that may be at risk of someone getting online on the tax rolls online and finding their address and publishing that out on social media, you know, with nefarious purposes, which we saw happen in Gulfport a few years ago with an officer involved shooting. And they published the wrong officer's address. So this other officer is getting harassed by people showing up at his house because he was doxed. That's D-O-X-X. I think that's how I'm pronouncing that right. But I would like to have that. I would like to have first responders have the ability to go to their tax office and give them a form and say, please remove my personal information from online. It's still available. If you go through your regular public records request, if you can still get that, it's still available. But just make it a little tougher for people that want to harass our law enforcement officers. I think that's something we need to look at.
Do you think there's an appetite along those lines? It just kind of made me think about it, Senator, of perhaps restricting access to social media within the state for certain age groups?
I wish that we could legislate that. I'm not sure that we can. I know other states are doing it. And look, Senator Nicole Boyd and Bart Williams, they're looking at it very strongly. I would love to do it, but we can't legislate for parents to parent, in other words. Look, my kids don't have social media. We're not going to let them have social media. We make them bring their phones downstairs and leave them downstairs when they go to bed at night. There's no need for them to have a phone, at those hours of the night. If parents would start doing that, I think we'd see it go away. But look, social media is not a place for kids under 18. We're seeing bullying happening. They've got access to things they don't need. So I would encourage parents not to let their kids do it. Look, your kids aren't going to like you for it, but they're not supposed to like you sometimes when you take a stance like that and parent them. But we'll see some legislation, I'm sure. I'm just not sure how effective it can be.
Yeah, I think the nation of Australia just enacted legislation, law that prohibits use of anyone under the age of 16 across the nation of Australia. Kind of got on out there on that. What else do you guys think you're going to be working on? You know, the auditor has highlighted a fair amount of government waste, state government waste. Is this something that the legislature is thinking about taking up as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, we've got a state agencies, I think state agencies or government agencies committee now. I'm not sure of the name of the committee, but Chris Johnson is the chairman of that over in the Senate. I know he's got a counterpart, Hank Zuber, over in the House. And we're looking at everywhere we can clean up government waste. Yeah. If we've got agencies that aren't doing their job, if they're not spending their money correctly, we always need to be looking at that. And look, there's always fat to trim, too. That's one
absolutely
of our most important jobs.
Yeah, it's kind of a living organism is government. It tends to grow arms and legs. So, Senator, really appreciate you taking some time out of your day. It sounds like you guys are having a good hunt today. It's been kind of fun interviewing you there from wherever your location is in the camouflage. I really enjoyed that.
Lake Eddins. And look, man, I'm so happy to sit with my daughter and let her get her first deer today.
That's awesome. Congratulations on that. You and your family have a blessed and happy new year. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Gerard.
We're coming right back in the Element Wealth Studio.
Take a little trip with me.
The One on Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Shake it all the time.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. On the C Spire text line, Starkville City Schools did not benefit from the merger. My granddaughter taught there, and it was terrible. Ratio got real bad. School choice not good either. Crack down on public schools and expect more from teachers. Pay them more with success. Well, I certainly don't have a problem with structuring some sort of variable pay program, honestly, for all members of state government based on achievement of certain objectives. The concern I have, Rhino, is those things get gamed up, just like we have with respect to grading our schools. We now have, I think, two districts where the whole district is graded as a D or F. And in accordance with state law, with respect to location of charter schools, they can only locate in a D or F district. Now, my understanding is that there is some interest on the part of the legislature to perhaps allow C districts also to have a charter school located. We'll see where that goes. But, you know, this is, and we appreciate the text. I would be curious to know if that's a universal opinion, that the merger of the schools, the consolidation of schools, Starkville and Oktibbeha County, if everybody has a negative view and a negative feeling about that. Because I've heard others report positively on the matter. So that could be a problem with respect to school consolidation. But there's no doubt that there's some money to be saved in consolidation, although it's usually not as estimated. You could look at it and say, okay, we'll just get rid of all this and project that. But that's not normally how it works out in reality and in practice, for sure. We'll see certainly how that goes. What will the property taxes look like for someone who transfers to a district with a higher tax millage? That doesn't seem fair at first glance. So it's a good question, and this is where you got to dig into kind of the nuance of what an open enrollment, which is what that's referred to, a public school to public school transfer would look like. And it, again, the legislature can do whatever the heck they want in law, but generally speaking, if you look at the way such programs work in other states, such as Florida, Arizona, which are two kind of headline states for universal school choice. We're only talking about the state portion. So the school funding comes from a combination of a state set amount appropriated per student, and then the rest of the funding for the student comes from local taxes, typically ad valorem taxes, property taxes. You'll see that on your property tax bill, school district taxes. And generally speaking, the way it's been implemented elsewhere, the student, the family of the student, would be responsible for covering the local portion of the taxes for the school to which they transfer. You could live in a district, of course, and you're paying property taxes in that district. Those stay, based on law, in that district. If you transfer out of the district, now, if it's within the district, it's not a problem. Still within the district, because that's how the tax is paid at the district level. But if you transfer to a school out of the district, well, that does present a bit of a dilemma in that, generally speaking, the way that's structured, the student, the family, would be responsible for paying, kind of think about it as tuition, the local portion of those taxes to the receiving school. It's the way that would work. So I hope that answered the question. Casey says, regarding the school choice you're discussing, we do not need a law for that. Many school districts have tuition programs. Yeah, that's right. They do. State funding follows the student as we are paid based on enrollment. State funding, that's correct. The issue is, Casey, is that presently the school who is currently serving the transferring student can veto it and just stand in the way. Now, the district can, you know, have its own policies regarding that, but in general, the district or the school which loses the student would object. That's generally what's happened, which is why we don't have a lot of cases of open enrollment in the state of Mississippi. And so what the legislation would do in general is just eliminate that veto capability, if you will, so that the school which would lose the student via transfer, wouldn't be able to stand in the way. So that's essentially what's being talked about this coming year. It's called open enrollment, and it just really, again, removes the veto power of the sending district to stop the transfer, and it leaves the decision totally to the receiving district. But again, if it's outside of the district, then you got the issue of the local component of revenue. Yeah, so I know Casey serves on the school board in Ocean Springs, which is a really fine school district, if not the top ranked in the state. Ocean Springs tuition program only allows students who are enrolling in advanced programs such as AP, Capstone, and International Baccalaureate. Yeah, that's another nuance that could be added, and I just want to make the point, this can be structured however the legislature sees fit to take and enact into law. I mean, there's not like, well, this is the way it has to be done. It's like anything else. It's, you know, start with a clean slate, you start drafting legislation. But, I mean, the key element that's kind of common to all school choice is that the state portion of the funding follows the student to their education setting of choice, whether that's from one public school to another public school, whether that's public to private, public to home, micro school, whatever the case may be. And again, that can be crafted in legislation the way the legislature sees fit. I don't see any appetite from at least the lieutenant governor at this point to enact public to private transfer, or certainly universal school choice, where those families, those parents of students in private schools would also receive a tax credit equal to the amount allocated to their student for public education. Let's see here. Can you ask a representative, this is Mike in Columbus, Mississippi, if they are willing to cut the taxes off of retirement benefits, since I've paid income taxes in my adult working life, kind of like Trump cutting taxes off Social Security? Mike, already have that. Social Security, pension income, et cetera, in the state of Mississippi are exempt from state income tax. We already have that. Mo says, Gerard, years ago we had a teacher tell us that they taught hard material early in the school year expecting the state test scores to be low. Throughout the year, the material got easier to the students. State test scores would go up, which, to your point, Mo's, is in some districts used as a factor in calculating a bonus. So I hear you, and that's a concern. It's a legitimate concern, is the accountability model, the scoring model, and just how that's calculated. It's the same concern I have about what I asked the senator about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and just straight from the BLS website, I've dug into this extensively. It considers, I think this is important to understand, what's called the civilian non-institutional population age 16 or older. So if you're 120 years old and you're not working, you're considered not participating in the labor force. That's the way the calculation works. I think it's dumb, personally. It doesn't account for those who have legitimately decided to retire and don't need to work. They have other forms of income. That's why the number is misleading. And we have a lot of retired folks in Mississippi, which could explain why we have a low labor force participation rate. But I've yet to find anybody that's been called. I spoke, Rhino, a couple of weeks ago at a really nice retirement facility here in the state of Mississippi. None of them have ever been called. So, have you ever been called?
No. Not that I'm aware of.
I challenge anybody out there. Anybody ever been called?
I answer the phone when it's a number I don't recognize.
Well, so how do they come up with a number? That's the only point I'm making, is I'm not convinced that it's accurate. But the civilian and non-institutional means you're not in jail and you're not in a nursing home. That's non-institutional. And then it's, hey, are you working? Yes. Okay, you're employed. Are you not working? Right, I'm not working. Are you absent from your job because you're on vacation or ill? Yes. Okay, you're employed. That's the way they look at it. Are you being laid off or currently on layoff awaiting recall? Yes. Okay, you're employed. Are you looking at least in the last 4 weeks and available for work? Yes. Okay, well then, you're unemployed, but you're in the labor force. You see what I mean? That's what's crazy about it. And if you say none of the above, okay, well then you're not in the labor force. That's what I think's a problem. We're coming right back with the final segment on Middays.
Do you suffer?
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. Final segment of Middays here on this Monday. On the C Spire text line, Jana asks if there's any chance for a veteran service connected to have property taxes decreased due to the rating, like 70% gets 70% off property tax. I'm not sure if there's an exemption there. I don't think there is specifically for veterans on property taxes. I would certainly support any tax decrease. I would just point out that you get the counties and the cities squawking because it's less revenue for them. So mainly the counties and the school districts. That presents a problem. So they'd probably stand up and say, okay, legislature, you're taking some money out of our pocket, just like is the case with the sales tax on groceries. You're going to make us whole, right? You're going to raise the PERS rate. You're going to make us whole. You see the issue. And I see this happening, by the way, with respect to the federal government and the states. Same sort of relationship where if the federal government, this discussion I had last week, this segment during the show where I talked about the prospect of the federal government not just cutting back on the 90% enhanced federal match for Medicaid expansion, but cutting back on the current federal funding of Medicaid, which could impose a significant hardship on the state of Mississippi before it expands Medicaid, as it discusses that. And that's a problem that the legislature needs to certainly be considering when they're deliberating this issue, is that possibility. Because right now, I think Americans on November 5th said, quit the spending. Get your financial house in order there, federal government. Well, the Medicaid program is, I'd say, top of the list to get some chops. $620 billion a year. And that's what the governor had in his social media post, Rhino, both on Twitter and Facebook, had also shared our video about that and said, I agree with Middays 100%. So we appreciate the governor for giving us a shout out there. And he, of course, trying to send that message to the legislature as they consider such legislation. My point about the labor force participation rate is that while I know it kind of sounds good on paper, hey, we're going to cover the Senate's plan last year. All those in Mississippi would be eligible for Medicaid. If they're working and their income is less than 100% of the federal poverty level, that's about $15,000 a year, by the way. And they'd have to be working, which means they're working. If they're working full-time, they're working for minimum wage full-time, which is a small number of people. Honestly, based on the experience in the state of Georgia, they projected over 300,000 would sign up, 4,500 half. In 2 years. I think here in the state of Mississippi, we'd probably have fewer than 2,500 sign up. And it would cost us more to administer the program for 2,500 people. And that's because, again, this who's working issue is a big problem. I had a friend text me say it's really difficult to determine who's working because many people in the state of Mississippi don't have bank accounts, don't file tax returns, don't want to. Therefore, they can't prove they're working. We have the least banked state. We have a huge underground economy, all cash underground economy. They're not going to come forward and say, hey, I want to sign up for Medicaid. I'm working. Okay, well, show us some documents proving you're working. Okay, I'm not interested then. That's what would happen. I really do believe that. If you went to the average person on the street and said, hey, you know what? You could get free health care if you just go to work if you're not working. They'd say, what's Medicaid? I'm totally convinced of that. Oh, I don't need that. I get free health care now. So I would just caution the legislature as they debate this issue to get novel and think about something out of the box on this issue. Mike in Gulfport says, there's so many problems with public education. My wife taught over 20 years in Florida and Mississippi, and in both systems we have allowed the inmates to run the institution. Gerard, when I was at Murrah and you were probably at St. Joe, we were made to behave and given short-term vacation or had to deal with the Board of Education, board in all caps, a figurative term there too in his meaning. We learned the three R's in respect, responsibility, and accountability. I believe we should take control again, and if a school has failed, then replace the problems in that school. Good leaders don't just let failure happen. So, Mike, I hear you, man. But I would just share this with you. And this is something that I heard from my daughter, who taught for 8 years in public school. If you impose that kind of discipline, you know what happens, Rhino. The parents march their butt up to the school and go have a conversation with the principal and start making all these threats. The problem is home. You shouldn't need to learn respect and responsibility and accountability in a high school. That should have been happening at the house. The problem, once again, is what house? What parents? What adult guiders in their life? That's the problem that we got to solve. It's a cultural problem way before it gets into the schools. They should be respectful before they get there. And if you try to, again, discipline them, all hell breaks loose on you just because you're doing the right thing. I didn't get today to this very controversial matter that cropped up over the weekend about the H-1B visa program. Turns out Elon Musk, Vivek Ramaswamy, and the president-elect are all on the same page, but we're going to get to that tomorrow. Folks, I hope you have a great Monday. We'll be back with you again on Tuesday. Until then, stay safe and God bless.
A Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.